He looked like a quiet neighbor, clean-cut, shy, the kind of man who helped carry groceries or apologized for the noise. But inside apartment 213 of the Oxford Apartments in Milwaukee, Jeffrey Dahmer was preserving heads in his refrigerator, bleaching skulls, and dissolving flesh in acid. He lured young men, mostly black, brown, poor, or queer, into his home with promises of money or photos. They never came back. Police knocked on his door, more than once. Neighbors screamed, smelled rotting flesh, saw boys fleeing, but no one stopped him. Why? This isn't just the story of a killer. It's a story of how law enforcement looked the other way, again and again, because of race, poverty, and sexual orientation. The most chilling part? One victim escaped. He was brought back by the cops, straight into Dahmer's hands. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Monster in Apartment 213, July 22, 1991. The night the horror ended, or began, depending on where you start the story. That summer evening in Milwaukee was ordinary on the surface, but inside a rundown apartment on 25th Street, horror lived behind a beige door with a broken lock. The man who answered the door, Jeffrey Lionel Dahmer, smelled like chemicals. His shirt stuck to his thin body with sweat. His blue jeans were stained, but when he opened the door to the three police officers behind a terrified black man in handcuffs, he smiled calmly. Tracy Edwards, the man who'd escaped, told the officers Dahmer had tried to kill him. He'd been lured under the pretense of taking nude photos. Once inside, Edwards was handcuffed, shown a knife, and threatened. But through some miracle of psychological manipulation, talking Dahmer down, stalling, he survived long enough to flee. Barefoot, shirtless, shackled. The police entered the apartment with caution. It wasn't caution they needed, it was body bags. In the bedroom, an open drawer revealed Polaroids. Not just of nude men, but of corpses. Some dismembered, some posed post-mortem, some photographed mid-butcher. They were trophies. Memories Dahmer had made, kept, and relived. Then came the fridge. Inside was a severed human head. In the freezer, three more. A metal drum in the bedroom held decomposing body parts, acid vats, bleach, a toolbox of surgical instruments. And behind it all, a man who didn't run or fight. He just said, "For what I did, I should be dead." But to understand the apartment of death, you need to understand the man who created it. From quiet boy to predator, Jeffrey Dahmer was born in 1960 in Milwaukee. His father, Lionel, was a chemist. His mother, Joyce, suffered from anxiety, depression, and multiple hospitalizations. Their home was filled with tension. Jeffrey grew up shy and isolated. But that wasn't unusual. What was unusual was his fascination with death. Roadkill, dissected frogs, and bones. By age 10, he collected animal carcasses, dissected them, and stored them in jars. Most saw a quiet boy, but the signs were there. In high school, he began drinking heavily. He didn't fit in. He didn't date. He later admitted that his first sexual stirrings were tied to thoughts of control, dominance, and death. His first murder came in 1978. Stephen Hicks, 18. They met hitchhiking. Dahmer lured him home, shared drinks. When Hicks tried to leave, Dahmer panicked. He bludgeoned him with a dumbbell. He later said, "I didn't want him to go." He crushed the bones, dissolved flesh, scattered the remains in the woods behind his house. He was 18. The missed chances. In 1988, Dahmer was convicted of sexual assault for molesting a 13-year-old boy. He was sentenced to 1 year in a work release program and 5 years probation. The judge allowed him to keep his job. He served only 10 months. Less than 2 years later, he murdered that boy's brother, Konarak Synthesomphone, 14. On May 27, 1991, Konarak escaped Dahmer's apartment, drugged and bleeding. He was found by two black women, who called 911. Police arrived, but Dahmer convinced them that the boy was his 19-year-old boyfriend, drunk from a spat. Despite the women's protests, despite the child's obvious condition, they let him go, with Dahmer. Within minutes, Konarak was dead. Dahmer later photographed his corpse, kept his skull. Why didn't police run a background check? Why didn't they see the boy was 14? Why didn't they believe the women? The answers are as chilling as the crimes. Racism. Homophobia. A belief that what happened between two gay men wasn't worth their attention. The victim pattern. Invisible lives. Between 1987 and 1991, Dahmer murdered 17 young men and boys. Most were people of color. Many were gay or struggling with poverty, immigration, or homelessness. They were easy to lure, easy to disappear, easy to ignore. Their names mattered. Anthony Hughes, Jamie Dockstater, Richard Guerrero, Errol Lindsay, Jeremiah Weinberger, and more. He offered them $50, posed as a photographer, or offered shelter. Sometimes they were drugged. Others were strangled, drilled in the skull, or injected with acid. He tried to create zombies, permanent sex slaves. He didn't just kill. He kept parts, skulls, genitalia, hearts. He ate some of them. He posed their bodies. He watched the Polaroids. Again and again, inside the mind. At trial, Dahmer pled guilty but insane. Experts argued over his sanity. He was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, schizotypal disorder, necrophilia. But the court ruled he knew right from wrong. He was sentenced to 15 consecutive life sentences, 937 years, but not everyone was satisfied. Glenda Cleveland, a neighbor, had called police many times. She saw Konarak. She reported screams. She smelled the death, but no one listened. She told reporters, "The police failed those boys. Society failed those boys." Ending with vengeance. On November 28, 1994, in Columbia Correctional Facility, Dahmer was beaten to death by fellow inmate Christopher Scarver. Scarver said he was disgusted by Dahmer's behavior in prison. Dahmer reportedly mocked other inmates, shaped food into body parts, and used ketchup to mimic blood. Many saw Scarver as delivering justice where the system had failed. But others asked, why did Dahmer make it to prison in the first place? Why wasn't he caught after the first murder, or the second, or when police were inside his apartment? The aftermath. The Oxford apartments were demolished. Milwaukee tried to forget. But the legacy of Jeffrey Dahmer isn't just about a killer. It's about a system that didn't care until white families were affected. About how marginalized lives are treated as disposable. About how evil often hides in plain sight. Helping neighbors, smiling politely, while horror waits inside. Chapter 2. The Boys Who Never Came Home. What makes a serial killer infamous isn't just the horror they cause. It's the silence surrounding the victims. The Jeffrey Dahmer case isn't only about a predator. It's about society's decision, conscious or not, that some lives simply matter less. Boys vanished, families screamed, neighbors begged for help. And still, police knocked on apartment 213's door and walked away, leaving bodies behind. This chapter is about those boys, their names, their stories, and the trail of institutional failure that let a cannibal keep killing for 13 years. It could have been me. Milwaukee's forgotten sons. The faces of Dahmer's victims weren't the kind the media clung to. These weren't suburban high school valedictorians with prom photos on the fridge. Most were poor, black, Latino, Asian, gay, or all of the above. To the media, they were only defined by how they died, not who they were. But they had lives, dreams, families. Anthony Sears, age 24, was a model and aspiring designer. He met Dahmer at a bar in 1989, Dahmer's first victim after a 9-year gap. It was Anthony's last night alive. Dahmer said he was so beautiful, he wanted to keep a piece. He kept his head and genitals in a wooden box. Eddie Smith, 28, was a known face in Milwaukee's underground gay scene. His sister Carol reported him missing in June 1990. He was never seen again. She never got a call from police until she saw her brother's name on a list of Dahmer's victims over a year later. Jamie Dockstater, only 14, had recently left a foster home. Half Native American, half Mexican, he was picked up at a bus stop. He thought he was going to earn some money. Instead, Dahmer drugged and strangled him. His remains were never returned to his family. The list continues, one after another. So many victims, so many missed chances. Warning signs that no one listened to, Between 1988 and 1991, police were called to Dahmer's residence multiple times. Loud screams reported by neighbors, foul smells coming from his unit, a naked boy running into the street, clearly drugged and bleeding, and each time law enforcement dismissed the concerns, not once, not twice, but at least five times. In fact, one of the most damning moments in modern policing happened on May 27, 1991, when 14-year-old Konarak Synthesomphone escaped, bleeding, disoriented, naked, surrounded by alarmed neighbors, and police brought him back, despite clear signs of trauma, despite being a minor, despite Dahmer being a registered sex offender who had previously molested Konarak's older brother. Police concluded it was a domestic squabble between lovers. They joked about the incident on police radio. The officers were suspended, but reinstated. Their names, Joseph Gabrisch and John Balkazak. They later became president of the Milwaukee Police Union, Dahmer's zombie experiments. The details are almost beyond belief. Dahmer admitted to trying to create a sex slave by drilling into victims' skulls while they were alive and pouring in hydrochloric acid or boiling water. He hoped to induce a permanent state of submission, alive but without will. He practiced on multiple victims, including Tony Hughes, 31, a deaf man. They communicated via handwritten notes. Dahmer later posed his corpse in various positions, photographing every angle. Errol Lindsay, 19, the first victim who wasn't gay. Dahmer simply wanted to try something different. He injected boiling water directly into his brain. These weren't just murders. They were experiments, torture sessions, art projects in the mind of a psychopath who wanted to own people completely, body and soul. The nice guy. Lie much of the media at the time described Dahmer as polite, soft-spoken, even remorseful, but that narrative ignored the mockery and games he played in prison. Christopher Scarver, the man who ultimately killed Dahmer in prison, said Dahmer shaped food into human limbs and spilled ketchup to simulate blood. He laughed when other inmates talked about their dead loved ones. He joked about skulls. Scarver eventually snapped, beating Dahmer and another inmate to death in 1994 with a metal bar in the prison gym. "God told me to do it," Scarver said, "but many saw it as karma." Victim's voice. Who were the boys behind the horror? The question rarely asked, who were these boys before they met Jeffrey Dahmer? They were Richard Guerrero, 25, a loyal son and brother. He often helped his mother with errands. He dreamed of owning his own business. Joseph Braidhoft, 25, a father of three. He had just moved to Milwaukee to start a new job. He was killed days later. Curtis Strauter, 18, a young black gay man who wanted to be a model. He was planning to go to beauty school. Jeremiah Weinberger, 23, an outgoing, well-liked young man who worked at a video store. He was murdered after going to Milwaukee for the weekend. Their stories were not about how they died, but how they lived, and how society didn't fight for them. The parents who screamed into the void families tried to get help, but no one listened. Teresa Smith, Eddie's sister, called hospitals, shelters, and police. Nothing. Isabel Lacey, Anthony Hughes's mother, begged officers to investigate when her deaf son disappeared. Nothing. Sufanath Synthesomphone, Konarak's father, said, "They treated us like we didn't matter, like we weren't American." When the full extent of Dahmer's crimes was revealed, families were offered no reparations, no psychological counseling, no justice, only horror. Inside the system that failed them, let's break it down. Racial bias. Most victims were people of color. Police dismissed concerns from black and Asian families. Victims were labeled runaways or delinquents without investigation. Homophobia. Milwaukee law enforcement treated gay bars, gay neighborhoods, and gay complaints as less urgent. Officers refused to enter Dahmer's apartment after Konarak's escape, fearing gay stuff. Classism. Victims came from poor neighborhoods. Many were unemployed, homeless, or vulnerable. Predators like Dahmer knew those are the people society ignores. Overcrowded system. Some defenders said the police were overwhelmed, but that doesn't explain ignoring a naked, drugged child running from a registered sex offender. Could it happen again? Yes, it already has, Dharma is not a one-off. He is a symptom. Consider these questions. Why are missing Black and Latino boys reported far less often than white girls? Why do police still dismiss domestic or LGBTQ plus abuse as non-urgent? Why are killers often described as quiet loners instead of predators? Until those answers change, there will be more Jeffrey Dahmers and more victims we won't remember until it's too late. The afterlife of a cannibal. After Dahmer's death, his apartment building was demolished. Families requested their son's remains be returned. In some cases, they got fragments, bone shards, teeth. For others, nothing. His brain was preserved for scientific study. But eventually, his father had it cremated at the request of his mother, Joyce. Dahmer's case became a media obsession. Documentaries, films, t-shirts, even Halloween costumes. Some people called it true crime culture. Others called it profit from pain. But behind the headlines are 17 families who still mourn, 17 boys who never got to grow old, and a city that never fully reckoned with what happened inside that small rotting apartment.